and many steps more to the concentration camp at Dachau. I climbed through the windshield of the truck, found the diseased man, and jumped out the back. His sole was skinny. His beard was a ball and chain. My feet landed loudly in the gravel, though not a sound was heard by a soldier or prisoner. But they could all smell me. Recollection tells me that there were many wishes in the back of that truck. Inner voices called out to me. Why him and not me? Thank God it isn't me. The soldiers, on the other hand, were occupied with a different discussion. The leader squashed his cigarette and asked the others a smoggy question. When was the last time we took these rats for some fresh air? His first lieutenant choked back a cough.
They could sure use it, couldn't they?
Well, how about it, then? We've got time, don't we?
We've always got time, sir.
And it's perfect weather for a parade, don't you think?
It is, sir.
So what are you waiting for?
On Himmel Street, Liesel was playing soccer when the noise arrived. Two boys were fighting for the ball in the midfield when everything stopped. Even Tommy Müller could hear it.
What is that?
He asked from his position in goal. Everyone turned toward the sound of shuffling feet and regimented voices as they made their way closer.
Is that a herd of cows? Rudy asked. It can't be. It never sounds quite like that, does it?
Slowly at first, the street of children walked toward the magnetic sound, up towards Frau Diller's. Once in a while, there was added emphasis in the shouting. In a tall apartment just around the corner on Munich Street, an old lady with a foreboding voice deciphered for everyone the exact source of the commotion. Up high, in the window, her face appeared like a white flag with moist eyes and an open mouth. Her voice was like suicide, landing with a clunk at Liesel's feet. She had grey hair. The eyes were dark, dark blue.
"Die Juden," she said. "The Jews."
Duden Dictionary, meaning number 6. Elend, misery. Great suffering, unhappiness and distress. Related words, anguish, torment, despair, wretchedness, desolation. More people appeared on the street, where a collection of Jews and other criminals had already been shoved past. Perhaps the death camps were kept secret, but at times people were shown the glory of a labor camp like Dachau. Far up on the other side, Liesel spotted the man with his paint cart. He was running his hand uncomfortably through his hair.
Up there, she pointed out to Rudy. My papa.
They both crossed and made their way up, and Hans Hubermann attempted at first to take them away.
Liesel, he said, maybe...
He realized, however, that the girl was determined to stay, and perhaps it was something she should see. In the breezy autumn air, he stood with her. He did not speak. On Munich Street, they watched. Others moved in around and in front of them. They watched the Jews come down the road like a catalogue of colours. That wasn't how the book thief described them, but I can tell you that that's exactly what they were, for many of them would die. They would each greet me like their last true friend, with bones like smoke, and their souls trailing behind. When they arrived in full, the noise of their feet throbbed on top of the road. Their eyes were enormous in their starving skulls. And the dirt was molded to them. Their legs staggered as they were pushed by soldiers' hands, a few wayward steps of forced running before the slow return to a malnourished walk. Hans watched them above the heads of the crowding audience. I'm sure his eyes were silver and strained. Liesel looked through the gaps, or over shoulders. The suffering faces of depleted men and women reached across to them, pleading not so much for help, they were beyond that, but for an explanation, just something to subdue this confusion. Their feet could barely rise above the ground. Stars of David were plastered to their shirts, and misery was attached to them as if assigned. Don't forget your misery. In some cases, it grew on them like a vine. At their side, the soldiers also made their way past, ordering them to hurry up and to stop moaning. Some of those soldiers were only boys. They had the Führer in their eyes. As she watched all of this, Liesel was certain that these were the poorest souls alive. That's what she wrote about them. Their gaunt faces were stretched with torture. Hunger ate them as they continued forward, some of them watching the ground to avoid the people on the side of the road. Some looked appealingly at those who had come to observe their humiliation, this prelude to their deaths. Others pleaded for someone, anyone, to step forward and catch them in their arms. No one did. Whether they watched this parade with pride, temerity, or shame, nobody came forward to interrupt it. Not yet. Once in a while, a man or woman, no, they were not men and women, they were Jews, would find Liesel's face among the crowd. They would meet her with their defeat, and the book thief could do nothing but watch them back in a long, incurable moment before they were gone again. She could only hope they could read the depth of sorrow in her face, to recognize that it was true and not fleeting. "I have one of you in my basement," she wanted to say. "We built a snowman together. I gave him 13 presents when he was sick." Liesel said nothing at all. What good would it be? She understood that she was utterly worthless to these people. They could not be saved, and in a few minutes she would see what would happen to those who might try to help them. In a small gap in the procession, there was a man, older than the others. He wore a beard and torn clothes. His eyes were the colour of agony, and weightless as he was too heavy for his legs to carry. Several times he fell. The side of his face was flattened against the road. On each occasion, a soldier stood above him. "Steh auf!" he called down. "Stand up!" The man rose to his knees and fought his way up. He walked on. Every time he caught up sufficiently to the back of the line, he would soon lose momentum and stumble again to the ground. There were more behind him, a good truck's worth, and they threatened to overtake and trample him. The ache in his arms was unbearable to watch as they shook, trying to lift his body. They gave way one more time before he stood and took another group of steps. He was dead. The man was dead. Just give him 5 more minutes, and he would surely fall into the German gutter and die. They would all let him, and they would all watch. Then one human. Hans Hubermann. It happened so quickly. The hand that held firmly onto Liesel's let it drop to her side as the man came struggling by. She felt her palm slap her hip. Papa reached into his paint cart and pulled something out. He made his way through the people, onto the road. The Jew stood before him, expecting another handful of derision, but he watched with everyone else as Hans Hubermann held his hand out and presented a piece of bread, like magic. When it changed hands, the Jew slid down. He fell to his knees and held Papa's shins. He buried his face between them and thanked him. Liesel watched. With tears in her eyes, she saw the man slide farther forward, pushing Papa back to cry into his ankles. Other Jews walked past, all of them watching this small, futile miracle. They streamed by, like human water. That day, a few would reach the ocean. They would be handed a white cap. Wading through, a soldier was soon at the scene of the crime. He studied the kneeling man and Papa, and he looked at the crowd. After another moment's thought, he took the whip from his belt and began. The Jew was whipped 6 times, on his back, his head, and his legs. "You filth! You swine!" Blood dripped now from his ear. Then it was Papa's turn. A new hand held Liesel's now, and when she looked in horror next to her, Rudi Steiner swallowed as Hans Hubermann was whipped on the street. The sound sickened her, and she expected cracks to appear on her papa's body. He was struck 4 times before he too hit the ground. When the elderly Jew climbed to his feet for the last time and continued on, he looked briefly back. He took a last sad glance at the man who was kneeling now himself, whose back was burning with four lines of fire, whose knees were aching on the road. If nothing else, the old man would die like a human. Or at least with the thought that he was a human. Me? I'm not so sure if that's such a good thing. When Liesel and Rudy made it through and helped Hans to his feet, there were so many voices. Words and sunlight. That's how she remembered it. The light sparkling on the road, and the words like waves breaking on her back. Only as they walked away did they notice the bread sitting rejected on the street. As Rudy attempted to pick it up, a passing Jew snatched it from his hand, and another two fought him for it as they continued on their way to Dachau. Silver eyes were pelted then. A cart was turned over, and paint flowed onto the street. They called him a Jew lover. Others were silent, helping him back to safety. Hans Hubermann leaned forward, arms outstretched against the house wall. He was suddenly overwhelmed by what had just happened. There was an image, fast and hot. 33 Himmel Street. Its basement. Thoughts of panic were caught between the in-and-out struggle of his breath. They'll come now. They'll come. Oh, Christ. Oh, crucified Christ. He looked at the girl and closed his eyes. Are you hurt, Papa? She received questions rather than an answer. What was I thinking? His eyes closed tighter and opened again. His overalls creased. There was paint and blood on his hands. And breadcrumbs. How different from the bread of summer. Oh, my God, Liesel. What have I done? Yes, I must agree. What had Papa done? Peace. At just after 11 p.m. that same night, Max Vandenberg walked up Himmel Street with a suitcase full of food and warm clothes. German air was in his lungs. The yellow stars were on fire. When he made it to Frau Diller's, he looked back one last time to number 33. He could not see the figure in the kitchen window, but she could see him. She waved, and he did not wave back. Liesel could still feel his mouth on her forehead. She could smell his breath of goodbye. "I have left something for you," he'd said, "but you will not get it until you're ready." He left. "Max!" But he did not come back. He had walked from her room and silently shut the door. The hallway murmured. He was gone. When she made it to the kitchen, Mama and Papa stood with crooked bodies and preserved faces. They'd been standing like that for 30 seconds of forever. Duden Dictionary, meaning number 7. Schweigen. Silence. The absence of sound or noise. Related words? Quiet. Calmness. Peace. How perfect. Peace. Somewhere near Munich, a German Jew was making his way through the darkness. An arrangement had been made to meet Hans Hubermann in 4 days, that is, if he wasn't taken away. It was at a place far down the Amper, where a broken bridge leaned among the river and trees. He would make it there, but he would not stay longer than a few minutes. The only thing to be found there when Papa arrived 4 days later was a note under a rock at the base of a tree. It was addressed to nobody and contained only one sentence. The last words of Max Vandenberg. You've done enough. Now more than ever, 33 Himmel Street was a place of silence. And it did not go unnoticed that the Duden Dictionary was completely and utterly mistaken, especially with its related words. Silence was not quiet or calm, and it was not peace. The Idiot and the Coatmen. On the night of the parade, the idiot sat in the kitchen, drinking bitter gulps of Holzapfel's coffee and hankering for a cigarette. He waited for the Gestapo, the soldiers, the police, for anyone to take him away as he felt he deserved. Rosa ordered him to come to bed. The girl loitered in the doorway. He sent them both away and spent the hours till morning with his head in his hands, waiting. Nothing came. Every unit of time carried with it the expected noise of knocking and threatening words. They did not come. The only sound was of himself. "What have I done?" he whispered again. "God, I'd love a cigarette," he answered. He was all out. Liesel heard the repeated sentences several times, and it took a lot to stay by the door. She'd have loved to comfort him, but she had never seen a man so devastated. There were no consolations that night. Max was gone, and Hans Hubermann was to blame. The kitchen cupboards were the shape of guilt, and his palms were oily with the memory of what he'd done. They must be sweaty, Liesel thought, for her own hands were soaked to the wrists. In her room, she prayed, hands and knees, forearms against the mattress. "Please, God, please let Meg survive. Please, God, please." Her suffering knees, her painful feet. When first light appeared, she awoke and made her way back to the kitchen. Papa was asleep with his head parallel to the tabletop, and there was some saliva at the corner of his mouth. The smell of coffee was overpowering, and the image of Hans Hubermann's stupid kindness was still in the air. It was like a number or an address. Repeat it enough times, and it sticks. Her first attempt to wake him was unfelt, but her second nudge of the shoulder brought his head from the table in an upward shock. "Are they here?"
"No, Papa, it's me."
He finished the stale pool of coffee in his mug. His Adam's apple lifted and sank. "They should have come by now. Why haven't they come, Liesel?" It was an insult. They should have come by now and swept through the house, looking for any evidence of Jew-loving or treason. But it appeared that Max had left for no reason at all. He could have been asleep in the basement, or sketching in his book.
"You can't have known that they wouldn't come, Papa."
"I should have known not to give the man some bread. I just didn't think."
"Papa, you did nothing wrong."
"I don't believe you."
He stood and walked out the kitchen door, leaving it ajar, lending even more insult to injury. It was going to be a lovely morning. When 4 days had elapsed, Papa walked a long length of the Amper River. He brought back a small note and placed it on the kitchen table. Another week passed, and still Hans Hubermann waited for his punishment. The welts on his back were turning to scars, and he spent the majority of his time walking around Molking. Frau Diller spat at his feet. Frau Holzapfel, true to her word, had ceased spitting at the Huberman's door, but here was a handy replacement.
"I knew it," the shopkeeper damned him. "You dirty Jew lover."
He walked obliviously on, and Liesel would often catch him at the Amper River, on the bridge. His arms rested on the rail, and he leaned his upper body over the edge. Kids on bikes rushed past him, or they ran with loud voices and the slaps of feet on wood. None of it moved him in the slightest. Duden Dictionary, meaning number 8. Nachtrauen, regret. Sorrow filled with longing, disappointment, or loss. Related words, rue, repent, mourn, grieve. "Do you see him?" he asked her one afternoon when she leaned with him. "In the water there." The river was not running very fast. In the slow ripples, Liesel could see the outline of Max Vandenberg's face. She could see his feathery hair and the rest of him.
"He used to fight the Führer in our basement."
"Jesus, Mary and Joseph." Papa's hands tightened on the splintery wood. "I'm an idiot."
"No, Papa. You're just a man." The words came to her more than a year later when she wrote in the basement. She wished she'd thought of them at the time.
"I am stupid,"
Hans Huberman told his foster daughter, and kind, which makes the biggest idiot in the world. The thing is, I want them to come for me. Anything's better than this waiting. Hans Huberman needed vindication. He needed to know that Max Vandenberg had left his house for good reason. Finally, after nearly 3 weeks of waiting, he thought his moment had come. It was late. Liesel was returning from Frau Holzapfel's when she saw the two men in their long black coats, and she ran inside.
"Papa! Papa!"
She nearly wiped out the kitchen table.
"Papa, they're here!"
Mama came first.
"What's all this shouting about, Zalmensch? Who's here?"
"The Gestapo!"
"Hansi!"
He was already there, and he walked out of the house to greet them. Liesel wanted to join him, but Rosa held her back, and they watched from the window. Papa was poised at the front gate. He fidgeted. Mama tightened her grip on Liesel's arms. The men walked past. Papa looked back at the window, alarmed, then made his way out of the gate. He called after them.
"Hey, I'm right here. It's me you want. I live in this one."
The coatmen only stopped momentarily and checked their notebooks.
"No, no," they told him. Their voices were deep and bulky. "Unfortunately, you're a little old for our purposes."
They continued walking, but they did not travel very far, stopping at number 35 and proceeding through the open gate.
"Frau Steiner?" they asked when the door was opened.
"Yes, that's right."
"We've come to talk to you about something."
The coatmen stood like jacketed columns on the threshold of the Steiner's shoebox house. For some reason, they'd come for the boy. The coatmen wanted Rudy. Part 8. The Word Shaker. Featuring dominoes and darkness, the thought of Rudy naked, punishment, a promise keeper's wife, a collector, the bread eaters, a candle in the trees, a hidden sketchbook, and the anarchist's suit collection. Dominoes and Darkness. In the words of Rudy's youngest sisters, there were two monsters sitting in the kitchen. Their voices kneaded methodically at the door as three of the Steiner children played dominoes on the other side. The remaining three listened to the radio in the bedroom, oblivious. Rudy hoped this had nothing to do with what had happened at school the previous week. It was something he had refused to tell Liesel and did not talk about at home. A grey afternoon. A small school office. Three boys stood in a line. Their records and bodies were thoroughly examined. When the fourth game of dominoes was completed, Rudy began to stand them up in lines, creating patterns that wound their way across the living room floor. As was his habit, he also left a few gaps, in case the rogue finger of a sibling interfered, which it usually did.
"Can I knock them down, Rudy?"
"No."
"What about me?"
"No, we all will."
He made three separate formations that led to the same tower of dominoes in the middle. Together, they would watch everything that was so carefully planned collapse, and they would all smile at the beauty of destruction. The kitchen voices were becoming louder now, each heaping itself upon the other to be heard. Different sentences fought for attention, until one person, previously silent, came between them.
"No,"
she said. It was repeated, "No." Even when the rest of them resumed their arguments, they were silenced again by the same voice, but now it gained momentum.
"Please," Barbara Steiner begged them. "Not my boy."
"Can we light a candle, Rudy?"
It was something their father had often done with them. He would turn out the light, and they'd watch the dominoes fall in the candlelight. It somehow made the event grander, a greater spectacle. His legs were aching anyway.
"Let me find a match."
The light switch was at the door. Quietly, he walked toward it with the matchbox in one hand, the candle in the other. From the other side, the three men and one woman climbed to the hinges.
"The best scores in the class," said one of the monsters.
such depth and dryness. Not to mention his athletic ability.
Damn it. Why did he have to win all those races at the carnival? Deutscher. Damn that Franz Deutscher.
But then he understood. This was not Franz Deutscher's fault, but his own. He'd wanted to show his past tormentor what he was capable of, but he also wanted to prove himself to everyone. Now everyone was in the kitchen. He lit the candle and switched off the light.
Ready?
But I've heard what happens there. That was the unmistakable, oaky voice of his father.
Come on, Rudy, hurry up.
Yes, but understand, Herr Steiner, this is all for a greater purpose. Think of the opportunities your son can have. This is really a privilege.
Rudy, the candle's dripping.
He waved them away, waiting again for Alex Steiner. He came.
Privileges? Like running barefoot through the snow? Like jumping from 10-meter platforms into 3 feet of water?
Rudy's ear was pressed to the door now. Candle wax melted onto his hand.
Rumors.
The arid voice, low and matter-of-fact, had an answer for everything.
Our school is one of the finest ever established. It's better than world-class. We are creating an elite group of German citizens in the name of the Führer.
Rudy could listen no longer. He scraped the candle wax from his hand and drew back from the splice of light that came through the crack in the door. When he sat down, the flame went out, too much movement. Darkness flowed in. The only light available was a white rectangular stencil, the shape of the kitchen door. He struck another match and reignited the candle, the sweet smell of fire and carbon. Rudy and his sisters each tapped a different domino, and they watched them fall until the tower in the middle was brought to its knees. The girls cheered.
Kurt, his older brother, arrived in the room. They looked like dead bodies, he said.
What?
Rudy peered up at the dark face, but Kurt did not answer. He'd noticed the arguing from the kitchen.
What's going on in there?
It was one of the girls who answered, the youngest, Bettina. She was 5.
There are 2 monsters, she said. They've come for Rudy.
Again, the human child. So much cannier. Later, when the coat men left, the 2 boys, 1 17, the other 14, found the courage to face the kitchen. They stood in the doorway. The light punished their eyes. It was Kurt who spoke.
Are they taking him?
Their mother's forearms were flat on the table, her palms were facing up. Alex Steiner raised his head. It was heavy. His expression was sharp and definite, freshly cut. A wooden hand wiped at the splinters of his fringe, and he made several attempts to speak.
Papa.
But Rudy did not walk toward his father. He sat at the kitchen table and took hold of his mother's facing up hand. Alex and Barbara Steiner would not disclose what was said while the dominoes were falling like dead bodies in the living room. If only Rudy had kept listening at the door just for another few minutes. He told himself in the weeks to come, or in fact pleaded with himself, that if he'd heard the rest of the conversation that night, he'd have entered the kitchen much earlier.
I'll go, he'd have said. Please take me. I'm ready now.
If he'd intervened, it might have changed everything. 3 possibilities. 1, Alex Steiner wouldn't have suffered the same punishment as Hans Hubermann. 2, Rudy would have gone away to school. 3, and just maybe, he would have lived. The cruelty of fate, however, did not allow Rudy Steiner to enter the kitchen at the opportune moment. He'd returned to his sisters and the dominoes. He sat down. Rudy Steiner wasn't going anywhere. The thought of Rudy naked. There had been a woman standing in the corner. She had the thickest braid he'd ever seen. It roped down her back, and occasionally when she brought it over her shoulder, it lurked at her colossal breast like an overfed pet. In fact, everything about her was magnified. Her lips, her legs, her paved teeth. She had a large, direct voice. No time to waste.
"Come,"
she instructed them.
"Come, stand here."
The doctor, by comparison, was like a balding rodent. He was small and nimble, pacing the school office with his manic yet businesslike movements and mannerisms. And he had a cold. Out of the three boys, it was difficult to decide which was the more reluctant to take off his clothes when ordered to do so. The first one looked from person to person, from the aging teacher to the gargantuan nurse to the pint-sized doctor. The one in the middle looked only at his feet, and the one on the far left counted his blessings that he was in the school office and not a dark alley. The nurse, Rudy decided, was a frightener.
"Who's first?"
she asked. It was the supervising teacher, Herr Heckenstaller, who answered. He was more a black suit than a man. His face was a moustache. Examining the boys, his choice came swiftly.
"Schwarz."
The unfortunate Jürgen Schwarz undid his uniform with great discomfort. He was left standing only in his shoes and underwear. A luckless plea was marooned on his German face.
"And," Herr Heckenstaller asked, "the shoes?"
He removed both shoes, both socks.
"Und die Unterhosen?" said the nurse. "And the underpants?"
Both Rudy and the other boy, Olaf Spiegel, had started undressing now as well, but they were nowhere near the perilous position of Jürgen Schwarz. The boy was shaking. He was a year younger than the other two, but taller. When his underpants came down, it was with abject humiliation that he stood in the small, cool office. His self-respect was around his ankles. The nurse watched him with intent, her arms folded across her devastating chest. Heckenstaller ordered the other two to get moving. The doctor scratched his scalp and coughed. His cold was killing him. The three naked boys were each examined on the cold flooring. They cupped their genitals in their hands and shivered like the future. Between the doctors coughing and wheezing, they were put through their paces.
"Breathe in."
Sniffle.
"Breathe out."
Second sniffle.
"Arms out now."
A cough.
"I said arms out."
A horrendous hail of coughing. As humans do, the boys looked constantly at each other for some sign of mutual sympathy. None was there. All three pried their hands from their penises and held out their arms. Rudy did not feel like he was part of a master race.
"We are gradually succeeding," the nurse was informing the teacher, "in creating a new future. It will be a new class of physically and mentally advanced Germans. An officer class."
Unfortunately, her sermon was cut short when the doctor creased in half and coughed with all his might over the abandoned clothes. Tears welled up in his eyes, and Rudy couldn't help but wonder. A new future, like him? Wisely, he did not speak it. The examination was completed, and he managed to perform his first nude Heil Hitler. In a perverse kind of way, he conceded that it didn't feel half bad. Stripped of their dignity, the boys were allowed to dress again, and as they were shown from the office, they could already hear the discussion held in their honor behind them.
"They're a little older than usual," the doctor said, "but I'm thinking at least two of them."
The nurse agreed.
"The first and the third."
Three boys stood outside, first and third.
"First was you, Schwarz," said Rudy. He then questioned Olaf Spiegel. "Who was third?"
Spiegel made a few calculations. Did she mean third in line or third examined? It didn't matter. He knew what he wanted to believe.
"That was you, I think."
"Cow shit, Spiegel. It was you."
A small guarantee. The coachman knew who was third. The day after they'd visited Himmel Street, Rudy sat on his front step with Liesel and related the whole saga, even the smallest details. He gave up and admitted what had happened that day at school when he was taken out of class. There was even some laughter about the tremendous nurse and the look on Jürgen Schwarz's face. For the most part, though, it was a tale of anxiety, especially when it came to the voices in the kitchen and the dead body dominoes. For days, Liesel could not shift one thought from her head. It was the examination of the three boys. Or, if she was honest, it was Rudy. She would lie in bed, missing Max, wondering where he was, praying that he was alive. But somewhere, standing among all of it, was Rudy. He glowed in the dark, completely naked. There was great dread in that vision, especially the moment when he was forced to remove his hands. It was disconcerting, to say the least, but for some reason, she couldn't stop thinking about it. Punishment. On the ration cards of Nazi Germany, there was no listing for punishment, but everyone had to take their turn. For some, it was death in a foreign country during the war. For others, it was poverty and guilt when the war was over, when 6 million discoveries were made throughout Europe. Many people must have seen their punishments coming, but only a small percentage welcomed it. One such person was Hans Hubermann. You do not help Jews on the street. Your basement should not be hiding one. At first, his punishment was conscience. His oblivious unearthing of Max Vandenberg plagued him. Liesel could see it sitting next to his plate as he ignored his dinner, or standing with him at the bridge over the Amper. He no longer played the accordion. His silver-eyed optimism was wounded and motionless. That was bad enough, but it was only the beginning. One Wednesday in early November, his true punishment arrived in the mailbox. On the surface, it appeared to be good news. Paper in the kitchen. We are delighted to inform you that your application to join the NSDAP has been approved.
The Nazi Party? Rosa asked. I thought they didn't want you.
They didn't. Papa sat down and read the letter again. He was not being put on trial for treason or for helping Jews or anything of the sort. Hans Hubermann was being rewarded. At least, as far as some people were concerned, how could this be possible?
There has to be more.
There was. On Friday, a statement arrived to say that Hans Hubermann was to be drafted into the German army. A member of the party would be happy to play a role in the war effort, it concluded. If he wasn't, there would certainly be consequences. Liesel had just returned from reading with Frau Holzapfel. The kitchen was heavy with soup steam and the vacant faces of Hans and Rosa Hubermann. Papa was seated. Mama stood above him as the soup started to burn.
God, please don't send me to Russia, Papa said.
Mama, the soup's burning.
What?
Liesel hurried across and took it from the stove.
The soup.
When she'd successfully rescued it, she turned and viewed her foster parents. Faces like ghost towns.
Papa, what's wrong?
He handed her the letter, and her hands began to shake as she made her way through it. The words had been punched forcefully into the paper. The contents of Liesel Memminger's imagination. In the shell-shocked kitchen, somewhere near the stove, there's an image of a lonely, overworked typewriter. It sits in a distant, near-empty room. Its keys are faded, and a blank sheet waits patiently upright in the assumed position. It wavers slightly in the breeze from the window. Coffee break is nearly over. A pile of paper the height of a human stands casually by the door. It could easily be smoking. In truth, Liesel only saw the typewriter later when she wrote. She wondered how many letters like that were sent out as punishment to Germany's Hans Hubermanns and Alex Steiners, to those who helped the helpless, and those who refused to let go of their children. It was a sign of the German army's growing desperation. They were losing in Russia. Their cities were being bombed. More people were needed, as were ways of attaining them, and in most cases, the worst possible jobs would be given to the worst possible people. As her eyes scanned the paper, Liesel could see through the punched letter holes to the wooden table. Words like compulsory and duty were beaten into the page. Saliva was triggered. It was the urge to vomit.
What is this?
Papa's answer was quiet. I thought I'd taught you to read, my girl. He did not speak with anger or sarcasm. It was a voice of vacancy, to match his face. Liesel looked now to Mama. Rosa had a small rip beneath her right eye, and within the minute her cardboard face was broken. Not down the center, but to the right. It gnarled down her cheek in an arc, finishing at her chin. 20 minutes later, a girl on Himmel Street. She looks up. She speaks in a whisper.
The sky is soft today, Max. The clouds are so soft and sad and...
She looks away and crosses her arms. She thinks of her papa going to war and grabs her jacket at each side of her body.
And it's cold, Max. It's so cold.
5 days later, when she continued her habit of looking at the weather, she did not get a chance to see the sky. Next door, Barbara Steiner was sitting on the front step with her neatly combed hair. She was smoking a cigarette and shivering. On her way over, Liesel was interrupted by the sight of Kurt. He came out and sat with his mother. When he saw the girl stop, he called out,
"Come on, Liesel. Rudy will be out soon."
After a short pause, she continued walking toward the step. Barbara smoked. A wrinkle of ash was teetering at the end of the cigarette. Kurt took it, ashed it, inhaled, then gave it back. When the cigarette was done, Rudy's mother looked up. She ran a hand through her tidy lines of hair.
"Our papa's going too,"
Kurt said. Quietness then. A group of kids was kicking a ball up near Frau Diller's. "When they come and ask you for one of your children," Barbara Steiner explained to no one in particular, "you're supposed to say yes." The Promise Keeper's Wife. The basement, 9 a.m., 6 hours till goodbye. "I played an accordion, Liesel. Someone else's." He closes his eyes. "It brought the house down." Not counting the glass of champagne the previous summer, Hans Huberman had not consumed a drop of alcohol for a decade. Then came the night before he left for training. He made his way to the Knoller with Alex Steiner in the afternoon and stayed well into the evening. Ignoring the warnings of their wives, both men drank themselves into oblivion. It didn't help that the Knoller's owner, Dieter Westheimer, gave them free drinks. Apparently, while he was still sober, Hans was invited to the stage to play the accordion. Appropriately, he played the infamous Gloomy Sunday, the anthem of suicide from Hungary, and although he aroused all the sadness for which the song was renowned, he brought the house down. Liesel imagined the scene of it, and the sound. Mouths were full, empty beer glasses were streaked with foam, the bellows sighed, and the song was over. People clapped, their beer-filled mouths cheered him back to the bar. When they managed to find their way home, Hans couldn't get his key to fit the door, so he knocked repeatedly.
"Rosa!"
It was the wrong door. Frau Holzapfel was not thrilled.
"Schwein, you're at the wrong house."
She rammed the words through the keyhole.
"Next door, you stupid Saukerl."
"Thanks, Frau Holzapfel.
You know what you can do with your thanks, you asshole."
"Excuse me?"
"Just go home."
"Thanks, Frau Holzapfel."
"Didn't I just tell you what you can do with your thanks?"
"Did you?"
It's amazing what you can piece together from a basement conversation and a reading session in a nasty old woman's kitchen.
"Just get lost, will you?"
When, at long last, he came home, Papa made his way not to bed, but to Liesel's room. He stood drunkenly in the doorway and watched her sleep. She awoke and thought immediately that it was Max.
"Is it you?"
she asked.
"No," he said.
He knew exactly what she was thinking.
"It's Papa."
He backed out of the room and she heard his footsteps making their way down to the basement. In the living room, Rosa was snoring with enthusiasm. Close to 9 o'clock the next morning, in the kitchen, Liesl was given an order by Rosa.
"Hand me that bucket there."
She filled it with cold water and walked with it down to the basement. Liesl followed in a vain attempt to stop her.
"Mama, you can't."
"Can't I?"
She faced her briefly on the steps.
"Did I miss something, Zalmensch? Do you give the orders around here now?"
Both of them were completely still. No answer from the girl.
"I thought not."
They continued on and found him on his back, among a bed of drop sheets. He felt he didn't deserve Max's mattress.
"Now, let's see," Rosa lifted the bucket, "if he's alive."
"Jesus, Mary and Joseph!"
The watermark was oval-shaped, from halfway up his chest to his head. His hair was plastered to one side, and even his eyelashes dripped.
"What was that for?"
"You old drunk!"
"Jesus!"
Steam was rising weirdly from his clothes. His hangover was visible. It heaved itself to his shoulders and sat there like a bag of wet cement. Rosa swapped the bucket from left hand to right.
"It's lucky you're going to the war," she said.
She held her finger in the air and wasn't afraid to wave it.
"Otherwise, I'd kill you myself. You know that, don't you?"
Papa wiped a stream of water from his throat.
"Did you have to do that?"
"Yes, I did."
She started up the steps.
"If you're not up there in 5 minutes, you get another bucketful."
Left in the basement with Papa, Liesl busied herself by mopping up the excess water with some drop sheets. Papa spoke. With his wet hand, he made the girl stop. He held her forearm. "Liesl," his face clung to her, "do you think he's alive?" Liesl sat. She crossed her legs. The wet drop sheet soaked onto her knee.
"I hope so, Papa." It felt like such a stupid thing to say, so obvious, but there seemed little alternative.
To say at least something of value and to distract them from thoughts of Max, she made herself crouch and placed a finger in a small pool of water on the floor.
"Guten Morgen, Papa."
In response, Hans winked at her. But it was not the usual wink. It was heavier, clumsier. The post-Max version, the hangover version. He sat up and told her about the accordion of the previous night, and Frau Holzapfel. The kitchen, 1 p.m. 2 hours till goodbye.
"Don't go, Papa, please."
Her spoon-holding hand is shaking.
"First we lost Max. I can't lose you now, too."
In response, the hungover man digs his elbow into the table and covers his right eye.
"You're half a woman now, Liesl."
He wants to break down, but wards it off. He rides through it.
"Look after Mama, will you?"
The girl can make only half a nod to agree.
"Yes, Papa."
He left Himmel Street, wearing his hangover and a suit. Alex Steiner was not leaving for another 4 days. He came over an hour before they left for the station and wished Hans all the best. The whole Steiner family had come. They all shook his hand. Barbara embraced him, kissing both cheeks.
"Come back alive."
"Yes, Barbara." And the way he'd said it was full of confidence. "Of course I will." He even managed to laugh.
"It's just a war, you know. I've survived one before."
When they walked up Himmel Street, the wiry woman from next door came out and stood on the pavement.
"Goodbye, Frau Holzapfel. My apologies for last night."
"Goodbye, Hans, you drunken Saukerl."
But she offered him a note of friendship, too.
"Come home soon."
"Yes, Frau Holzapfel. Thank you."
She even played along a little.
"You know what you can do with your thanks."
At the corner, Frau Diller watched defensively from her shop window, and Liesl took Papa's hand. She held it all the way along Munich Street to the Bahnhof. The train was already there. They stood on the platform. Rosa embraced him first. No words. Her head was buried tightly into his chest. Then gone. Then the girl.
"Papa?"
Nothing. Don't go, Papa. Just don't go. Let them come for you if you stay, but don't go. Please, don't go.
Papa.
The train station, 3 p.m. No hours, no minutes till goodbye. He holds her. To say something, to say anything, he speaks over her shoulder.
Could you look after my accordion, Lise? I decided not to take it.
Now he finds something he truly means. And if there are more raids, keep reading in the shelter. The girl feels the continued sign of her slightly growing chest. It hurts as it touches the bottom of his ribs.
Yes, Papa.
A millimeter from her eyes, she stares at the fabric of his suit. She speaks into him.
Will you play us something when you come home?
Hans Hubermann smiled at his daughter then, and the train was ready to leave. He reached out and gently held her face in his hand.
I promise, he said, and he made his way into the carriage.
They watched each other as the train pulled away. Liesel and Rosa waved. Hans Hubermann grew smaller and smaller, and his hand held nothing now but empty air. On the platform, people disappeared around them until no one else was left. There was only the wardrobe-shaped woman and the 13-year-old girl. For the next few weeks, while Hans Hubermann and Alex Steiner were at their various fast-tracked training camps, Himmel Street was swollen. Rudy was not the same. He didn't talk. Mama was not the same. She didn't berate. Liesel, too, was feeling the effects. There was no desire to steal a book, no matter how much she tried to convince herself that it would cheer her up. After 12 days of Alex Steiner's absence, Rudy decided he'd had enough. He hurried through the gate and knocked on Liesel's door.
Kommst?
Ja.
She didn't care where he was going or what he was planning, but he would not be going without her. They walked up Himmel, along Munich Street, and out of Molking altogether. It was after approximately an hour that Liesel asked the vital question. Up till then, she'd only glanced over at Rudy's determined face, or examined his stiff arms and the fisted hands in his pockets.
Where are we going?
Isn't it obvious?
She struggled to keep up. Well, to tell you the truth, not really.
I'm going to find him.
Your papa?
Yes. He thought about it. Actually, no. I think I'll find the Führer instead. Faster footsteps.
Why?
Rudy stopped.
Because I want to kill him.
He even turned on the spot to the rest of the world.
Did you hear that, you bastards? He shouted. I want to kill the Führer.
They resumed walking and made it another few miles or so. That was when Liesel felt the urge to turn around.
It'll be dark soon, Rudy.
He walked on.
So what? I'm going back.
Rudy stopped and watched her now, as if she were betraying him.
That's right, book thief. Leave me now. I bet if there was a lousy book at the end of this road, you'd keep walking, wouldn't you?
For a while, neither of them spoke, but Liesel soon found the will.
You think you're the only one, Zaukerl?
She turned away.
And you only lost your father. What does that mean?
Liesel took a moment to count. Her mother, her brother, Max Vandenberg, Hans Hubermann, all of them gone. And she'd never even had a real father.
It means, she said, I'm going home.
For 15 minutes she walked alone, and even when Rudy arrived at her side with jogging breath and sweaty cheeks, not another word was said for more than an hour. They only walked home together with aching feet and tired hearts. There was a chapter called Tired Hearts in A Song in the Dark. A romantic girl had promised herself to a young man, but it appeared that he had run away with her best friend. Liesel was sure it was chapter 13.
My heart is so tired, the girl had said.
She was sitting in a chapel, writing in her diary. No, thought Liesel as she walked. It's my heart that is tired. A 13-year-old heart shouldn't feel like this. When they reached the perimeter of Mulking, Liesel threw some words across. She could see Hubert Oval.
Remember when we raced there, Rudy?
Of course. I was just thinking about that myself. How we both fell.
You said you were covered in shit.
It was only mud.
He couldn't hold his amusement now.
I was covered in shit at Hitler Youth. You're getting mixed up, Zalmensch.
I'm not mixed up at all. I'm only telling you what you said. What someone says and what happened are usually two different things, Rudy, especially when it comes to you.
This was better. When they walked down Munich Street again, Rudy stopped and looked into the window of his father's shop. Before Alex left, he and Barbara had discussed whether she should keep it running in his absence. They decided against it, considering that work had been slow lately anyway, and there was at least a partial threat of party members making their presence felt. Business was never good for agitators. The army pay would have to do. Suits hung from the rails, and the mannequins held their ridiculous poses.
"I think that one likes you," Liesel said after a while.
It was her way of telling him it was time to keep going. On Himmel Street, Rosa Huberman and Barbara Steiner stood together on the footpath.
"Oh, Maria," Liesel said, "do they look worried?"
"They look mad." There were many questions when they arrived, mainly of the "just where in the hell have you two been?" nature. But the anger quickly gave way to relief. It was Barbara who pursued the answers.
"Well, Rudy?"
Liesel answered for him.
"He was killing the Führer," she said.
And Rudy looked genuinely happy for a long enough moment to please her.
"Bye, Liesel."
Several hours later, there was a noise in the living room. It stretched toward Liesel in bed. She awoke and remained still, thinking ghosts and Papa and intruders and Max. There was the sound of opening and dragging, and then the fuzzy silence who followed. The silence was always the greatest temptation. "Don't move." She thought that thought many times, but she didn't think it enough. Her feet scalded the floor. Air breathed up her pajama sleeves. She walked through the corridor darkness in the direction of silence that had once been noisy, toward the thread of moonlight standing in the living room. She stopped, feeling the bareness of her ankles and toes. She watched. It took longer than she expected for her eyes to adjust. And when they did, there was no denying the fact that Rosa Huberman was sitting on the edge of the bed with her husband's accordion tied to her chest. Her fingers hovered above the keys. She did not move. She didn't even appear to be breathing. The sight of it propelled itself to the girl in the hallway. A painted image. Rosa with accordion, moonlight on dark. 5'1", times instrument, times silence. Liesel stayed and watched. Many minutes dripped past. The book thief's desire to hear a note was exhausting, and still it would not come. The keys were not struck. The bellows didn't breathe. There was only the moonlight, like a long strand of hair in the curtain. And there was Rosa. The accordion remained strapped to her chest. When she bowed her head, it sank to her lap. Liesel watched. She knew that for the next few days, Mama would be walking around with the imprint of an accordion on her body. There was also an acknowledgement that there was great beauty in what she was currently witnessing, and she chose not to disturb it. She returned to bed and fell asleep to the vision of Mama and the silent music. Later, when she woke up from her usual dream and crept again to the hallway, Rosa was still there, as was the accordion. Like an anchor, it pulled her forward. Her body was sinking. She appeared dead. "She can't possibly be breathing in that position," Liesel thought, but when she made her way closer, she could hear it. Mama was snoring again. "Who needs bellows," she thought, "when you've got a pair of lungs like that?" Eventually, when Liesel returned to bed, the image of Rosa Huberman and the accordion would not leave her. The book thief's eyes remained open. she waited for the suffocation of sleep.
The Collector. Neither Hans Hubermann nor Alex Steiner was sent to fight. Alex was sent to Austria.